Hi, this is Paul, and this is our every week on Fridays from 10 to 12. I do a question and answer on the Bridges of Meaning Discord server. This week's recording is going to be shorter than most because this past week I put out a video on Living Stones Online and Estuary. And obviously in the Bridges of Meaning Discord server, that provoked a lot of questions. And we did the question and answer without recording. Some of the question and answers we do with recording so that they can be shared like I'm doing now. But some of the question and answers we do without recording because there's a special culture of being in the room. And so I know Discord servers are not for everyone. And some people prefer YouTube comments, and some people prefer other ways of interacting with online content like this. But the Discord, I think the Bridges of Meaning Discord server is an example of an estuary where the confluence of lots of different flows have come together, and there's some mushiness, and there's some chaos, and sometimes imbalance, but over the long haul, it's super productive, like an estuary. So we've been talking about muck and estuaries and plants and sea monsters. And hopefully over the next few months, we will continue to define what we're talking about in this estuary conversation and see where it goes. But now we've got more questions than we'll probably have time for. Joey is our moderator, and he's asked people to upvote the questions they most want answered, so we'll take them in the order of upvoting this week. So that's what we're going to do. So take it away, Joey.
Thanks, Paul. Our first question is from B. Palmer, and he's actually here to read his own question.
Super.
Hi, Paul. Can you guys hear me?
Hear you well.
Awesome. So, Paul, thanks for continuing to do this. So recently I have been thinking a lot about our notions of masculinity and femininity inside the church. Much of my thought kind of sparked from a lot of Jonathan Peugeot's stuff. And I've noticed, being in a church in Boston, that a lot of young men in my church, including myself, are big fans of guys like Joe Rogan, you know, Jocko Willink, and of course Jordan Peterson, who kind of embody a certain vision or vibe of masculinity. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on what you think we in the church can learn from these figures. Why do they have the appeal that they have? And what conclusion might we reach given the relative absence of men from the church at large?
This is a great question. You have a treat waiting for you next week that we'll have to see if it's a treat or not. So, Kristen Cobes-Dumez is a history professor at Calvin College, and she wrote a book, Jesus and John Wayne, How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation. And she had her publisher send me this book. She and I have some mutual friends in Grand Rapids. I am an alumnus of the history department of Calvin College. And she, when she was writing this book, she was going to write a chapter on Jordan Peterson. And so she was going to reach out to me and talk to me about it, but the book went a different way, and so she didn't have a chapter on Jordan Peterson. But I think this book would be hated by many of you in this community. I'll reserve my thumbs up or thumbs down opinion on the book for now. We'll see how my conversation with her plays out next week, because often I've done books that I've really wanted to promote, and at this point this is not a book I promote, but at the same time I want to have a productive conversation with her. I think there is a guy out of New York City who runs a newsletter, if that's what we can call it, sort of a blog, called The Masculinist. And he, for a while, was part of Tim Keller's Redeemer Presbyterian. And he has been trying to work through, He was a single guy, New York City, well-paying job, Christian, wanted to find out how, was working to figure out how to be a single Christian young man in this new milieu. Now, this is pre-Jordan Peterson that I started reading his new letter. I haven't read one for a while. He wrote some really interesting stuff. And one of the things that I remember, one of his posts, he talked about the fact, and we've touched on it briefly in some of our channels, that for some reason, Christianity sometimes comes off less masculine than, let's say, Judaism or Islam, which is really interesting. And sociologists have borne that out. Now, this is enormously ironic given the fact that in Christianity, you have Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Son is definitely gendered. God the Father is the source of gender, as we see in Genesis, or God is the source of gender. The Holy Spirit, that often gets debated. So what's with Christianity? And some people argue that, well, the importance of Mary in the Roman Catholic Church is a vital balance to this. And Jung and Jordan Peterson, a little bit following, sometimes almost wanted to elevate Mary in order to bring gender balance to the Godhead as such. So in thinking about my conversation next week with Kristen, I'm thinking about questions like, is going to work every day outside the home masculine or feminine? What is masculine and what is feminine? And probably someone who has taught me a lot about that has been Jonathan Peugeot, because in some ways, symbolism really lends itself to these really huge amorphous categories that defy easy description, both procedurally and propositionally. And I think that's part of the power of symbolism. And I think you're dead on right that Joe Rogan, Jocko Willink, Jordan Peterson, they send out a signal that inspires men to be men. And, you know, my conversation with Mary Cohen, where she talked about this, you know, masculine energy, and bottled up masculine energy is what builds skyscrapers and, you know, conquers the world. And this is part of, in her opinion at least, and I know not everybody shares her opinion, you know, Catholic social teaching. There's really something to be said for that. And I think we have in an attempt to try to address, inequities, if I dare use that word in a crowd like this, inequities and injustices against women historically, we have in some ways feminized our culture, perhaps putting it out of balance. And I think that's really what Jordan Peterson and many of these others are expressing and sensing and responding to. Because balance in a culture similar to balance in an estuary is a thing too big for any of us to control or even necessarily figure out how to measure well. When a biologist goes into an estuary and is attempting to get a sense of estuary health, I'm sure they will certainly have all of these ways of measuring things in the water or things in the soil or counting creatures. But we as human beings have this powerful intuitive sense of, if you've been in a lot of estuaries and you walk into one and you look around and you smell it, you might say, there's something going wrong here. And I don't know why. I might not be able to fix it, but something is out of balance. And I think we've seen that as a culture. And I think as as a Calvinist, I would say that in this world, something is always out of balance. And so figuring out the proper way for masculine and feminine to dance, that's what we're always up to. And so, well, let me get back to your question. A lot of young men in the church are big fans of Joe Rogan and Jocko Willink and Jordan Peterson, who embody a certain vision or vibe of masculinity. They do. And I think in many ways they are uncles and fathers, and they are inspiring young men. One of the things that, so we had kind of a core group meetup last week, actually it was this week. It's been such a busy week. And one of the things that came through in the discussion was the appreciation for the age diversity in our mostly male meetup, that we have older men and younger men. And a lot has been made of this in terms of fatherless households. And, you know, the fatherlessness of the house of households and the rise in children not growing up in a stable biological father, biological mother, biological children household in the culture is a sign that the ecosystem is not healthy. Because as Warren Farrell has noted in his work, boys and girls have different things to learn from dads and moms. And every dad is unique and every mom is unique. Every dad is, you know, both got some masculine and feminine qualities. Every mom has some masculine and feminine qualities. But our sex will obviously impact the mixture of masculine and feminine within us, as will our context and everything that shoots out there in terms of all of our aspects and variables. And so, you know, this has been going through in the church too. Etheridge, you know, Dumez points out some of those movements in the church, mostly in her book in a negative way. And so probably in the conversation, it's not going to be a debate. And I want to be her friend. But the challenging I hope to do will hopefully be seen as friendly and loving, because if you read the book of Proverbs, you know, that's often the way that we grow. And many of you have challenged me in many things, and you challenge me in your questions. And so I believe we can all grow together in that way. But we had promise keepers a generation ago in the church. One of the things that we have to recognize is that whereas we might live for 70 or 80 years, those first 20 years of our life are intensely formative. And so even though promise keepers happened in the 90s, people born in the 90s and afterwards wouldn't know the promise keepers movement in church. The promise keepers movement was a masculine movement, and it challenged in many ways sort of many things that Mary challenged, as Jordan Peterson did. Hey, you're a man. Is it strong to go out and rape a woman? Well, yeah, that shows physical strength, but what that doesn't show is strength of character. In fact, that is a thing that finally will not only destroy the woman, but will destroy you and will destroy your world. And, you know, that's part of the reason it's wrong. Real strength is restraint. And even in these movies that we see, and, you know, I loved when Jordan Peterson was taking his son to a movie, then his little son was scared, and Jordan would say, "Keep your eyes on the hero." That's exactly right, because, you know, thankfully in many of our heroic epics, the hero has strength, but only tries to use it for good. And the hero gets that wrong, and most of us do. But that's why these are archetypal stories, that the masculine hero uses masculine strength to use his power. This is Andy Crouch's ideas too, for flourishing in the community. for flourishing out beyond himself. And that's exactly why churches need to have estuaries. So, and then, as Peugeot has pointed out, part of the problem with the Wonder Woman figure is she's using so much masculine energy. And again, Peugeot points out that there's a place for this sometimes, but when you have a female using masculine energy as she is in a masculine way, it's sort of the exception. Because what's being abandoned, and of course, when you look at the woman who plays Wonder Woman in the movies, she's obviously also a drop-dead gorgeous woman, which is part of feminine power. And I often tell people, masculine power is impressive, and in some ways, at great insult to women, our culture has fetishized masculine power in a certain way and completely turned a blind eye to feminine power. And I'll tell people, masculine power, one strong man may best a weaker man. But as Jordan Peterson noted, and as the eight people had noted, two or three not as strong individual men can best the one strong man. Feminine power can redirect the attention of a million strong men. Which power is greater? Well, this is where a greater hierarchy doesn't really fit so well. And so, in a healthy ecosystem, there's masculine and there's feminine. And both powers have their own excellencies. And now each of us as individuals have masculine and feminine traits. Men, by virtue of our biology, tend to excel in the masculine. Women, by virtue of their biology, tend to excel in the feminine. Some men might be more feminine. Some women might be more masculine. That's part of normal variation in a healthy ecosystem. Now, what I think our culture has done in the lack of balance in many of these things is in failing to understand that we are too small to actually track all this stuff. And this is the way our culture is faithless, I believe, in failing to trust that, just as in an estuary, balance will be restored in time. We have built lots of levees, and we have dammed up the California Delta, and because we want to keep all of that fresh water flowing from the Sacramento and the San Joaquin, and we don't want to give any of it to the ocean, and like John Van Donk talked about some Dutch projects, they've destroyed an ecosystem, and it wasn't until the ecosystem was destroyed and its loss was felt by all did they realize, oh, maybe we should have trusted the Creator a little bit more. Maybe we should have had a little bit more humility about use of these incredibly powerful tools we've developed in the last 100 years. And maybe we should work with the Creator and with nature instead of against it. And I think we're seeing that in the church. Why do they have the appeal that they have? Because things are out of balance. What conclusions might we reach given the relative absence of men from the church at large? I don't think it's incidental or coincidental that estuary will, at least for a time, be dominated by men. Because, you know, so one of the conversations we had at our local meetup was, should we adopt a new name that is more male exclusive? And I sort of resisted that, even though my channel is 90% male in terms of Google Analytics. And I'm comfortable with that. Our meetup group is mostly men. I'm comfortable with that. And when I talked about this, some of the people in the meetup said, look, out there in the world right now, there are tons of female organizations. There are hardly any male organizations. There used to be 50 or 100 years ago. Most of them have gone away. I was reflecting on the fact that in my church, we, without any apology, have men's groups and women's groups. And we were struggling to get a men's group going. And one of the older men that participates in our men's groups, he kept asking me to start one. And I've tried starting men's groups for a long time. So we had the women's Bible study. And so he went to the leader of the women's Bible study and said, "Can I join your group?" And the women said, "No, you can't join our group. This is a women's group." And so he felt a little, you know, put off. And so then, you know, when we got the men's group going, he joined that. So, yeah, churches, the lack of men in church is a sign of something. So I have a niece who is getting her PhD in marine biology studying lobsters, of all things. Talk about irony. Well, guess what? She's studying lobsters in Narragansett Bay, and there are not anywhere near as many lobsters in Narragansett Bay as there used to be 50 years ago. All over the world right now, in the elite universities and institutions, everybody is able to say, "Whoa, while those lobsters are disappearing, is there a problem? We should study it." Well, if the men are walking out, and if there's even a movement that says men going their own way, maybe we should stop and say there's a problem. And maybe the best idea isn't just blaming men, because the best idea wasn't before just blaming women. Maybe we should be a little bit more humble and ask ourselves, what's going on? Let's study it. Let's not be afraid. Let's not be reactive. Let's have a conversation, and maybe we'll learn something. So that's my answer.
Okay, so we had a queue, but I'm going to cut in line because my question I asked is very much a follow-up to this. So I remember like 3 or 4 months ago, you mentioned this just very shortly at someone at the end of one of your videos. I don't remember which, but you said that, I can read it. It's the lack of community becomes sort of pathological for men. And it's not as easy identifiable that the cause is that you don't have any real context to put yourself in. It's not as if I mentioned in my question that, well, if you break a leg, it's kind of obvious what the source of your misery is, but the lack of community doesn't appear to you as such a thing. And I'm just, one question I wrote here was that, did you ever do a video about this? Because as you said, I might do a video about that sometime. But also, if you didn't, do you have any thoughts about this regarding the question you just answered?
I thought I gave you about 20 minutes of thought.
this is more about identifying the source is sort of what I'm coming at. Like, how does you're ending up in misery, but to you, suffering, it doesn't appear that it doesn't scream at you, "Oh, this is why I'm miserable here."
Right. Well, and figuring out why miserable, that's a really complex thing. So the church gets out of balance in terms of men and women. And the balance within church and men and women is not disconnected to what's going on in the broader society. So men are miserable in church, and so they leave. Okay, what are men going to do about it? Well, men can, you know, burn the church down. Oh, okay. So then women don't have a place to meet. Well, that doesn't sound very productive. Maybe we'll have a conversation. Okay. Well, actually burning the church down is a lot easier than having a conversation. Conversations are really tough. And in our current context, a lot of women are like, "Hey, you know what? Women, you know, they've developed history courses and women's studies, and women have gotten the short end of the stick from men forever. We call it patriarchy." Oh, okay. Well, they've got a whole thing that they're working on, patriarchy and women being victims, and, you know, well, you know, they've got some points in there. I'm sure they do. Okay, you're a man. How are you going to engage in conversation with someone who is ideologically possessed? Well, you know what? You're going to have to learn some exorcism ways. And today, a lot of those exorcism ways are probably adopting some of their own tricks. And that's some of the most clever opponents of ideologically possessed people have mastered the tricks of the ideological possession and use it against them. Because eventually, the truth is the truth is the truth. And so, if you can, as a man, okay, so maybe your masculine nature is a woman says something you don't like, well, hit her in the mouth and beat her up. Oh, okay. That's probably going to wind you up in jail, and all the other women are going to hate you. Not a good strategy. Why don't instead you figure out how to have a conversation with her? That's going to stretch you as a man. Here's one of the things that this entire cultural conversation completely misses that someone like Glenn Lowry picks up on. If you're in a weaker position, what is that a challenge and an opportunity for? For growth and strength. Because if you're in a privileged position, you are going to get fat and lazy because you are sitting on top of a structure that is benefiting you. So in some ways, the power of women that grew in the 19th and 20th century, they had a point. Men had the privilege of structure and position in some respects and grew lazy and grew dull and didn't have good arguments. Well, women have the ascension. Okay, men, you have brains too. Time to step up. Time to figure out how to have a conversation. Time to engage an adversary in a way that at the end you have made a friend. In fact, maybe even an ally. So, yeah, misery in many ways is the source of change. Figuring out where your misery comes from, as Jordan Peterson noted, well, that's half to three quarters of the battle. Because once you get that figured out, now you can do something.
I think something that we missed right there, too, was specifically men who are miserable because of lack of community. How will they know to identify that it's the lack of community or the lack of community that we feel in, say, our groups? How are they going to know that they're missing that and that that might be the solution to their problem?
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. That's the exact problem I wanted, because that's what you mentioned once, that you said, oh, I should do a video on that, then I don't know if you ever did.
I get 10 ideas for videos to every one I do. So, and that's why I appreciate this question and answer session, because you help me pick up things that I should have picked up but perhaps haven't. I think this is so in AA, the beginning of AA, you recognize your misery and you look to a higher power to help you with your misery. And the 12 steps of AA are all, it's all doing your own work, and it's all hard and uncomfortable. I have to do a fearless moral inventory of my defects and my past wrongs, and I have to go eat crow and make up for the past things that I've done wrong when it doesn't hurt someone. And when you think about this from the perspective of a junkie or an alcoholic, I mean, I have so much dealings with junkies and alcoholics because they have burned through their families. And this really hardy institution that is supposed to give us, you know, a sandbox to get dirty and make mistakes, these people have burned their families down and they are at rock bottom. Now they have to go back to their ex-wives and their parents and their children and say, I was a drunk. I screwed up your life. What can I do to make it better? And more often than not, the family says, I don't want to see your face again ever. Wow, that's hard. Okay, but the last step of AA is, now I need to go to all of those other drunks and help them. If there's one thing a drunk knows, it's how hard it is to help a drunk. because they have their reciprocal narrowing has gotten so bad that the door to their hell is locked from the inside, which is part of the reason that addicts are some of the most difficult people to work with. Okay? So men, you have found something that works for you. You have had a foretaste of community. You have seen at least a glimmer of light that leads out of the misery you've been in. It's your duty to take that message and take what you found to those other men who are suffering. And some of those men, perhaps, and this is where these conversations get tricky. Some of those men, well, as a pastor, one of the things you learn is timing is critical. And Jesus says, don't throw pearls before swine. What does that mean? If I show a human being a pearl, they'll say, oh, I can see the value of that. If I show my dog a pearl, my dog will sniff it and wonder, can I eat it? The dog has no use for the pearl. So when you're dealing with other men who you might look at and say, they are miserable, they need to come to my meetup. They need what I've got. Okay, good. Well, don't just put it in their face. That's like those stupid churches that Cassidy was talking about. They're not ready for it. Just come alongside. Be their friend. Wait for your moment. Wait for the time when everything is at a bottom and you can say, you're having a tough day. You know this group that I go to? You might enjoy it. Why don't you come with me? And they might come and say, it's not my cup of tea. Okay, no problem. But if you're right about the source of your misery, and if you're on to something about the remedy of your misery, you will naturally want to share it with people you love who are suffering from what you suffered from. And that goes with AA, that goes with church, that goes with a gym that you joined, it goes with a magazine that you read. So it's the duty of men who have found life-giving, productive community to share their community with other men. Now, I'm going to say something about men and women that would be controversial. I think women do that better and more naturally than men. And so one of the things that we've seen in our meetup is we need to do projects together because, as C.S. Lewis said, men build community side by side. Women build community face to face. So, men, do your slacklining, do your gym work, do your, you know, fix up some widow's home, you know, come rescue some dying church, even if you don't believe anything of what's going on there, and take some other men with you, because, well, here's the wonderful thing about how I believe God created men to be, and this is what Mary was talking about with her masculine energy. Guess what? When men are working side by side building things, guess what happens? Women have a place to live. And so I would argue that built right into who we are, men and women both flourish when we work together. Now, as society has gotten more and more complex, men have to learn to do the face-to-face thing women are good at. And that's really hard for men. Well, women sometimes have to learn the side-to-side thing that men are good at. That's hard for them. I've seen women come side-to-side, and the whole thing breaks out in a fight because, you know, and all they do is talk about their misery. And it's like, maybe you ladies should shut up and do something together. Ah, take your masculine wisdom and take a hike. Okay, well, you know, women are going to have to a certain degree, work out the stuff for women, and men are going to have to work out the stuff for men because men know what it's like to be a man better than women do and vice versa. And so that's, again, that little nugget is something that critical theory is in touch with, and it's a bit of truth there. But, yeah. I don't know. Did that help answer the question?
Yeah, a lot. So basically you're saying that it's really hard, if not impossible, to identify it, but it's also the duty of those who have found the institution useful to lead others suffering into the institution when the time is right.
Right. And that's the answer to the mercenary puzzle that, before we started recording, Cassidy had mentioned. Ideally, people in church that have found Oh, they have found everything. They found salvation in their own words. They found community. They found grace. They found truth. They found all this stuff. It should be natural for church people to want to go out and invite others. But part of the problem is that churches have adopted methods like the spouses of alcoholics. And so the spouse of the alcoholic thinks, I'm going to make my husband sober by hiding his bottles. Well, go to an Al-Anon meeting. What are they going to tell you? Nah, that's not going to make him sober. You're in fact enabling that. And I think part of where church evangelism has gone wrong is church evangelism has become, church evangelicals have become codependents with celebrity atheists. And when I look at some of those conversations, it looks just like the alcoholic and the, you can decide for yourself who's the alcoholic and who's the codependent spouse. But no, if done right, I often get criticized by Christians because I'm not inviting people to Christ like they think I should. And I say, I don't do that because I think actually, I don't often use these words, I think actually the way you're doing it is codependent. Why don't you respect the personhood, liberty, and autonomy of that other person? And, well, I think this is the biblical way. You will be my witnesses. Jesus doesn't tell his disciples, you will be my tyrants. Or you will be my jerks. You will be my witnesses. So, if you want to know how to do it, you look at Jesus. And, you know, Jesus offended the religious authorities of his own day because they thought he didn't toe the party line. And Jesus says, you can take your party line and, you know, anyway. I'm a preacher. I preach too much. Sorry about that.
Yeah, thanks for a really good answer.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. I'm just so fascinated by all of these topics. So I guess kind of a quick follow-up here. It strikes me that a lot of what you're talking about is kind of similar to Jordan Peterson's self-authoring program. You know, this idea that you could have what you want if you could only articulate it and then formulate kind of that vision and the plan for how you're going to move in that direction. Do you think, is there a sense in which, you know, so you just touched on this idea that, you know, we're witnesses of Christ, you know, that God, our faith is known only by witnesses, whether that's the witness of other Christians or the witness of the Holy Spirit directly. Like there's a sense in which it's kind of tied up in that I can't produce the vision for someone else, and that is there a sense in kind of in the church that we are kind of struggling to cast a kind of a new vision of the types of things that we ought to desire inside the church? Yeah, I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, that makes perfect sense.
Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's the role of the preacher to take the vision and put it into words. That's the role of the preacher. The role of the pastor is to create the community in which the vision can flourish. One of the surprising things and disappointing things about the Jordan Peterson wave from 2016 to 2019, and part of the reason I stepped in and did what I did was, here's a guy who studied alcoholism deeply. He knew 12-step programs deeply. And when I look at a self-authoring program, I see the middle steps of, I see some semblance of the middle steps of the 12 steps in that self-authoring program. There's 12 rules for life. There's 12 steps. There's, you know, look at that. But what he lacked was community. And so I think it's partly for that reason that when, you know, immediately when I started making videos, all these people were saying, you should start a meetup. You should start a meetup. And I was quite reluctant because hey, I'm a pastor. I got stuff to do. And I wanted to just talk about this stuff. I didn't want to do anything. And now people are like, you're a man. Be a man. Do something. Okay. So we started a meetup. And I think part of the reason Jordan Peterson meetups in that moment flourished so effectively was because he triggered this, but he didn't facilitate the, you know, to do a self-authoring program is wonderful. You need an accountability structure around you, because the stuff that you need other people who are both going to hold you accountable and encourage you, that's the two sides, to actually accomplish what your vision says, because most people I know can't do it on their own. And, you know, I'll tell you, you know, so I'm married to a woman, and she drives me crazy sometimes when, you know, this needs doing and that needs doing. And it's like, leave me alone. I want to be autonomous. And it's like, well, you're married. You can't be autonomous. You've got responsibilities at home. Okay. So you do those responsibilities. You might not like it, but you do it. And the weakness with just a self-authoring program is that, okay, you just put out this glorious vision. Along the way for that vision, there's a ton of stuff you're going to have to do that you don't want to do. Who's going to help you to do what you don't want to do? Well, you need the right balance of a community that you have willfully, voluntarily accepted, and that you're, whether out of pride or whatever, you're not going to abandon. And that's why you never see a successful team out there without a coach. And what does the coach do? The coach encourages and the coach chastises. And that's how championship teams are made. Jordan Peterson gave people a vision, but he didn't give them a team. And I knew that, and so we got to help build some teams here. That's what we're doing.
Okay, awesome. I think we're ready to move on to the next topic. So this question came from Jacob originally. I paraphrased it a bit to get it more focused. But Jacob asks, Hagia Sophia was recently turned into a mosque, which has a strong emotional impact on people of faith. This was a result of various people trying to liberate these structures, and others are trying to liberate it back. Is fighting for these buildings important, or signaling of a lack of faith? Should we be praying for the restoration of the temple or other sanctuaries? What about less spiritual, more worldly efforts? What role do and should physical sanctuaries play in our spiritual life? I personally find it a bit worrying that people are more concerned about space that is being desecrated by misguided faith than the hearts which are being desecrated by misguided faith. At the same time, what is the balance of man does not live by bread alone?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the Hagia Sophia is an interesting illustration, because I did an interview with a guy who's been interviewing Peugeot and Vervaeke and a whole bunch of people that we've known, and he's in Toronto and he's a filmmaker, and he made that film with Vervaeke and Peugeot and some others, and he's working on some more films. I did an interview with him yesterday. And, you know, I have to get back to my Vervaeke paper at some point, but I basically rolled out for him the secret second sister thesis of secularism and the church. So via Tom Holland, I made the point that in many ways, secularism is a secret second sister of the church, that when the first sister is rejected, the second sister conquers. And so the conversion, so the Hagia Sophia went from a church to a mosque to a museum, and now potentially back to a mosque. Now, buildings, I think, are, let's say these as works of our hands. In some ways, they're sort of analogous to Sauron's ring. What was Sauron doing when he made the ring? And this is Tolkien's mythology, of course. Sauron made the ring in order to make himself more powerful. So what he did was he distilled huge parts of himself into that ring. And so that ring both became an expression of him and, in a sense, if we translate this into buildings, and a space to colonize others. In a conversation between a friend of mine and an Orthodox priest in Sacramento, so my friend planted his church back in the Seeker days, and his church has gotten quite a bit more liturgical and sacramental since then. He was talking to this Orthodox priest friend of his, and the Orthodox priest friend of his said, well, we're not really evangelizing yet because we haven't built our cathedral or built our monastery yet. And to a Protestant hears that and thinks, huh? Because for Protestants, you build a building in order to house the body of believers, which are the people. That's a very Protestant perspective. An Orthodox perspective understands that in many ways the cathedral is a product of the body of believers, but the building itself possesses the spirit of the church. Let me say it that way. This gets into my school spirit thesis. And so what that building does is sort of, and I don't mean it this pejoratively, but just kind of the dynamic that Sauron's ring has. What that building does is enhances the power of the body of believers, that is the people themselves. And so that it's sort of like an amplifier, a sound amplifier. You put a mic and an amp and the voice is louder and more people can be reached. Now, with all of these amplifications, there are always signal to noise issues. And so in that sense, if things are on well in the organic body of believers, that is the communion of the saints and the people, the dynamics between the temple that they build or the cathedral that they build or the mosque that they build and the people will be out of sync. And I think this is what we see especially strongly in the book of Ezekiel, where the temple of the Lord and the people of the Lord are supposed to themselves be in perfect harmony. And the temple expresses, well, this gets even more complex in, because the temple is in a sense an embassy and a copy of the temple that is above the firmament. And in many ways, Genesis 1 is a temple text and Genesis 2 is the garden text. That's the paradise, the walled garden outside the temple. You know, Jonathan Peugeot's new image that he's constructing has so many of those elements in it. So when the people and the building are out of sync, the building, in a sense, starts to prophesy against the people. And what people will often do then is change the building. And so that's what we've seen in Hagia Sophia in its long history, from church to mosque to museum. And now with resurgent Islam and with the, in a sense, what we're seeing is perhaps the death of the second sister of the church, which is secularism. Her weaknesses have been exposed. Now, converting back to a mosque, yeah, it makes sense. And so, who's going to speak up? No, keep it a museum. Well, secular and secularish people are probably going to say that, because what they're doing is they're advocating for their religion. So physical sanctuaries in our spiritual life have an important role. Now, in plain, low church Protestantism, see, you can't build things and not express. So the plain meeting house of low church Protestants express something in that they are sort of saying, you know, what's the difference between a painting and a mirror? If someone paints a portrait of you and you keep it in your home and you look at the portrait, there's something going on between you and that portrait because there's a distance between you, but the portrait itself is an enhancement of you. Now, Protestant plain houses are more mirrors or glass walls because they're trying to say, don't look at the building, look at the people, because there's the body of Christ. And it's interesting, the little I know of rabbinic scholarship and Islamic theology, each of them have a sense of the same priesthood of believers. The church is not a building. The church is not a steeple. The church is not a resting place. Just that little song has so much built into it. The church is the people. Now, the church should be the people, which is a resting place. The people themselves should be that resting place. And, you know, we get this when Jesus says, you shall be my witnesses. So the people are always at the heart of the cathedral, but the cathedral or the temple or the mosque is sort of like Sauron's ring, not in a negative sense, but they have poured something of who they are into it, and it has become an amplification device. So now, if someone walks into a plain Protestant building, they, what do I know about this people? Not a lot until the people sort of come into the place. But if someone comes into a cathedral, well, the spirit of those, the spirit of the church itself, of the people that built that cathedral, lingers on in that cathedral. And as we've seen in Europe and in the Hagia Sophia, that's a powerful testimony. And so the Orthodox have a point when they build a cathedral. They say, this is bearing witness to the great cloud of witnesses. And it's right here in brick and stone and in paintings and artwork. And there it is. And the Protestants look at that and say, I want to be careful with that, because unless the physical community of Christ inside is in harmony with the cathedral on the outside, and usually that harmony is closest when it's built, then suddenly the walls of the cathedral, the stones of the temple, cry out against the purported shopkeepers and maintainers of the building itself. So, you know, that's a great question, and it's a very cool dynamic that I've never really explored. And this is, again, why I love these questions, because you bring me into places that I don't go myself. So thank you, Jacob. And any comeback on that, Jacob? Any yeah buts in this?
No, you actually just reminded me that in Judaism, you can't have prayer services until there are 10 people there. It doesn't matter if you're in a sanctuary. There has to be 10, well, in Orthodoxy, 10 men there, or it's still not a place to do worship.
Thank you. Thank you. No, that's good. And again, to me, what's the value? To me, Bridges of Meaning is an example of an estuary. And so here we have Jacob, and those of you outside this particular estuary that is Bridges of Meaning don't know Jacob, but his story is published on the Discord server, but that I did with him. But you know, so he's a Jew, and I don't mean just a biological Jew. He's a believing Jew, and so he's in the estuary. And that's really cool. And when I talk to Jacob, I learn. And, you know, to have an estuary where Dutch Calvinists can swim with Jews and can swim with atheists, and where the brackish water is such that, maybe we're both a little bit in stress from the presence of salt or lack of salt. But what's happening here is so productive. So I praise God for you, Jacob, and I'm really grateful that you've become a fixture of this estuary.
Now you're going to make me cry.
Okay, I'm going to go to our next question, which is from Gomer Day, who's here but not able to read it, so they've asked me to read it. Question for Pastor Paul. You recently have lost someone you loved. I lost my godmother this week and was wondering, what do you do in order for you to get back to life? I don't know if this information helps, but I was the one who discovered her body and called and reported it to the police. Thank you for your time.
I think, first of all, it's important. Our materialism does us a disservice here. Because, Gomer Day, you are a story. That is, you are an embodied story. You know, that's the nefesh that you are. That's the Hebrew word. And your, what did he say, his grandmother?
Godmother.
Godmother, okay. That's an especially good example. Your godmother, well, she's not necessarily, usually godmothers are chosen outside the biological family, inside the church family. Your godmother is part of that story. So when that nefesh that was your godmother died, she took part of, she took that story-making power that each of us have in our flesh and our physicality and our words and our presence here in this physical, larger physical world that is an estuary, here in this, that went away. So part of your story, part of the potentiality of your story died with her. That's, you know, and I felt this. So, you know, obviously when my sister died, I had been thinking about, I've been thinking for years about how we are story before the Jordan Peterson thing. And that's probably part of the reason I was drawn to these conversations. And so, you know, part of me thought it, what a strange thing that my sister who lived on the other side of the continent, who for the last number of years, you know, we didn't call much, we didn't talk much. When I'd go out there, we'd see each other, but we were quite close when we were younger because we were closer in age than myself and my older sister. But we haven't, and we were quite close in college, we were in college together. We haven't been that close for a number of years, but when my sister died, part of me died with her. C.S. Lewis made that comment with his friends, the Inklings, and Charles Williams died earlier than some of the other Inklings. Owen Barfield lived a long, long time, well into the 90s. But Lewis made the observation that when Charles Williams died, something in the community of their group died too. We have this philosophy that has been hegemonic for the last couple of hundred years that we are just simply biological creatures. And it's amazing that such a philosophy was able to spawn psychology, which notes that so much of us is not physical. So when you have a loss like this, take your time. We, you know, in past centuries, we have lost so much wisdom in modernity. In past centuries, if a wife were to lose her husband, she would wear black for a year. Now, that could be a little tyrannical, but there is also something to that where when someone saw this widow wearing black, they paused. Because one of the common things I hear from people when they grieve is my world was just torn apart. And when I look around me, the rest of the world is going on like business as usual. But it's not business as usual for me. It can't be. And when there was via clothing, or men would often wear a black armband, when there was via clothing an expression, a signal to everyone around you that was commonly understood that there's a rupture in the fabric of shalom, people would stop and say, I'm sorry for your loss. Can I sit with you? Can I pray with you? can I bring you some food? Because right now you don't feel like cooking because there's something celebrative in the process of cooking because you're making glory when you cook, if you're doing it well. And you don't want to make glory because part of you has been ripped away by death. And we signal to each other. And so in small ways, communities grieved with each other and marked that loss. And that was right. And we don't do that today. And in fact, today, what we do is, well, okay, someone dies. So, well, let's get the funeral or the service or whatever together. And let's try and get that done within a week, a couple of days or a week of two. And let's get them in the ground. And then, well, they're not back to normal yet. Well, let's get them to a grief group so they can get back to normal as quick as possible. Or maybe send them to a shrink so they can get back to normal as quick as possible. You know, my brother-in-law, lost a wife that he dearly loved. And those two were, you know, every relationship is different, but they're a wonderful pair. And because of my sister, that family worked. Not perfectly, no family is perfect, but the family worked. And my nieces and nephew, you know, they were working, they were going, it was, and then when my sister, by death, was ripped out of that system, the system doesn't work like it did. It's struggling to work at all. And now my brother-in-law, he's going to work and he's, you know, he's paying the bills and he's going to church and, you know, he's, and now he's trying to be father and mother to my nieces and my nephew, and they're in college or just graduated from college. They're young adults getting out into the world, and he's doing his best. And, you know, the people, they had good friends around them, and they're coming around to help. But, you know, if you look at my brother-in-law, and we as a family notice this, we say, oh, he's, you know, we want him to bounce out of this and do well. But part of us doesn't, because part of us knows if that happens, well, what did that mean about Lori? And the truth is, he's not as bubbly, he's not as happy. And, you know, and then sometimes people, well, Paul, do something about my brother-in-law. And so I'll approach him and I'll message him or something. And basically I'll tell him, I'll say, you know, take your time. If you were to walk down a street and a figure in a dark robe with a sigh came and with that sigh didn't chop off your head, but took a gouge out of your back. 3 days later, and people saw it was still bandaged and you were still sore and you couldn't quite get back to work, people wouldn't say, what's wrong with him? No, this guy with the sigh just took a pound of flesh out of his back. Give him some time to heal. He might need some professional help. He's going to need some time to get on his feet. Now, at some point, the wound does need to heal, because the loss can't be allowed to take your life completely. But it's going to take time. You might need some help. You definitely need a community around you. And by God's grace, as is often the case, if you're in a coherent, a healthy or somewhat healthy family, there are others around you who are grieving too. And so you can find community in the grief. And it's a strange thing that, unlike the pound of flesh that the grim reaper with the sigh or the sickle took out of you, the presence of the other wounded among you brings healing to each other. And so, yeah, I lament the fact that we as a society are no longer as cohesive, so that people don't have permission to mourn publicly longer than they used to have. And, you know, some of these traditions were a little arbitrary, so the woman wears black for a year. It's a degree better than in India before the British, where the woman throws herself on the funeral pyre of the husband. I'm not advocating that, although I have been at funerals where I've seen children of deceased fathers throw themselves on the casket, and in a sense want to join their father in the grave. You know, that shows how we are not just these biological creatures discreetly separated by sacks of skin. We are also spiritual. And what does that mean? We are embodied stories, and we are one to another. And so when the Grim Reaper has come and taken a few pounds of your flesh, maybe all of us should say, okay, maybe he needs a meal. Maybe he needs some company. Maybe we let him some slack, and when he's together with us, he's not as bubbly and effervescent as he used to be, and we'll worry about him. That's part of our concern, but we'll not rush him necessarily. Now, there are limits to this, and just like there are limits to many things, and professional help might be needed if the Grim Reaper with his sigh has taken too much flesh, but that's the process. So, Gomer Day, I'm sorry for your loss. And thank you for sharing that loss with us, because, again, in this disconnected cyber community, we won't necessarily see it. And thank you for asking the question, because I know that there are many, some here and some who will listen to this recording, that we as a society, we've gotten so smart in technology and so stupid with people so often. Grief is real. People need time. Community is real. I think we have one last question, then maybe I'll give a little summary. Sorry for all the questions we couldn't get to. We're probably going to have to figure out a way. You know, all of these questions and answers are ways of trying to balance availability in an open internet realm. So, you know, repost your questions, or maybe we'll, again, I like Joey's idea of upvoting questions, even though we need place for fringe and place for center. Upvote sort of expresses center. Low vote ones express fringe. And maybe in other weeks when, you know, if I keep doing this every week, you know, maybe I'll exhaust the questions at some point. So if your question didn't get answered, come back again next week, or at least post it in there. And if others come into there and you see a question that someone has posted previously that you really like, go ahead and upvote it. And maybe next week we'll continue to improve our process here.
All right. The only question I'm still holding on to is a longer one. So I'd rather give some time to the chat and see if anyone here has questions that are preferably shorter in nature.
Perfect.
How would you translate Isaiah 53?
Didn't you hear what Joey said? Oh, Isaiah 53.
The servant. It's a short question.
Yeah, you know, it's a short question, but it's a long answer, and one that requires. No, I can't. I'm not even going to try and answer that question right here, right now. How about a question with an answer that even I might be able to answer in less than 5 minutes?
All right. Well, if we've got nothing, then I'm going to suggest that we wrap this one up now and kind of go to a post chat.
Okay, I'll just again say that I thought we had a good, and this is for the recording, and we can have some post chat after, because I do stop the recording, and we usually talk a little bit more then. But Estuary and Living Stones Online is very much church oriented, and so some of you might notice that I see two sides of Paul sometimes. There's the side of Paul that is the Pastor Paul, and then there's the side of Paul that is the Estuary Paul, and Estuary and Living Stones Online are going to be two different things. Some people, especially in terms of financial support, some people want to give to Living Stones Online, and so giving to Living Stones Church is absolutely appropriate. Some people don't want to give to Living Stones Church, and if you want to support me, Patreon is still there. But by supporting Living Stones Church, you also do support me, because in many ways my mission in Estuary is also coming out of Living Stones. But I haven't figured out structures yet. Estuary especially is a very chaotic, living, dynamic thing, and that'll take more time to figure that out. Living Stones Online is easier for me to figure out because I know church and there are established structures, and I am working on all of the software, and hopefully many of you sent in emails to say I'd like to participate. I'm having someone go through them right now and incorporating you into the database of Living Stones Online. There'll be special emails for people who are participants or partners of Living Stones Online, and there'll be special video content on the Living Stones CRC Church channel, which is separate from my channel. And so Living Stones Online, though, is going to be very churchy, and that's because it's church. Estuary is not going to be churchy because it's not church, but I think churches have an interest in Estuary, but churches themselves cannot dominate or control Estuary. Estuary needs to be that open, productive space where the water from the river meets the water from the sea. And tides flow in and out, and floods flow in and out, and giant squid come in from the sea, and kayakers flow out into the ocean, and lots of chaotic, fun things happen that none of us can control. Because in many examples, human control destroys estuaries because they're too mysterious. They're too complex, they're too productive for us to know. And so, speaking as a Christian, I trust the Creator God of the world to do right by it. So that's go ahead.
I'd like to butt in for a quick second. If any of you are using Tithely to give, as Paul recommended, like you said, Paul, there is an option to have you yourself cover the cost so that Living Stones gets the full amount. That control is hidden. You need to scroll down a bit in that form. Otherwise, it won't show. You can still fill in your credit card information and click the big shiny donate button. But that little checkbox is cleverly hidden out of view. So
just he's right. It's quite a good platform, but I would like that checkbox to be a little bit more visible, but hey, also in terms of Patreon versus Tithely, now, of course, Patreon comes to me, Tithely goes to the church, and so that's one thing to know. Patreon takes out a bigger chunk than Tithely. Tithely is very economical, so Tithely is like 3%, Patreon's more like 10%, so that's one of the differences too, so. Thank you all. I will. Joey, you want to say something?
I would like to. Before we stop recording, I'd like to, on behalf of all of us from Bridges of Meaning, I'd like to just send a quick thank you to all the folks at Living Stones, the in-person church, both past and present. Without them giving us the opportunity and being generous with Paul's time, literally none of this would exist. So, just thank you again for all them and for all those who have built Living Stones and made it what it is today.
Thank you, Joey. All right, I will end recording.